This is a cultural icon interview, and we're talking this morning to Peter Smith. Welcome, Peter. It's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you, Rodney.
Peter, there are several aspects of your life we'd like to explore this morning, but most especially your role as an art educator, but even as an educator in a larger sense than that. I can think of nobody who has over half a century had a bigger impact on the unfolding of art education in New Zealand, the training of art teachers who in turn produce the young people that become our artists, and if not artists, take away attitudes towards art. Your influence on art in this country in that post-war period has been enormous. But before we get into that, I thought it'd be a good idea if we could look a little bit about your origins, where you came from, who your parents were and what they were like. You were a child of the Depression. What impact that had on you?
Yes, I often think that I was extremely fortunate. My father was a superb cabinet maker. My mother had been a teacher, but she was a staunch upholder of the Fabian Society, was very proud of having talked to George Bernard Shaw when he came to Auckland. They had a wonderful library. My father's firm that he worked for crashed, and we went to a tiny remote farm. And I realise now, and my brothers and sisters agree with me, that while we as children had plenty to eat and we went to the primary school, it destroyed my father's dignity. It took everything away from him that he had ever owned in terms of personal sense of personal pride. It was a very destroying influence. As a result of that move, because we were what in USA terms, southern USA terms, is called poor whites, the Maori people on the pa next door thought we must be city failures, so they didn't want much to do with us. And the wealthy farmers around us thought we were beneath, you know, their dignity to get to know. And that was something that took a long time for me to overcome, that sense of being thought of as inferior.
Yes.
In a way, it had a big influence on my whole career until I realised how silly I was being and that I was striving to be better, constantly wanting to be better, as good as them. It was a curious thing. But when I say I was fortunate that my great-uncle was John Leach, who founded the John Leach Gallery, and when my father could occasionally bring me to Auckland, I stayed in the Shortland Street attic above the studio, and here were all of these artworks, and it was fascinating. But my father was also quite a talented watercolourist, and we also had quite a collection of good original works in the house. So my parents would not part with their books, they would not part with their art. And so I think that I probably had a contact with art from a very early age, which I look back on now and think how fortunate I was.
Yes. The imprint. And your grandmother, I think, was also a big influence.
Oh, yes, dear Grandma Sarah. She was a remarkable lady. She was Welsh by origins and quite a hard case. But she took a fancy to me for some reason, and I spent all my school holidays with her. And I don't know where it started, but she used to get me books through the Left Wing Book Club, because she was a member of the Left Wing Book Club, which was horror to the local community. Here was this communist in their midst. And she ordered these wonderful volumes from Leningrad and places like that for me. So I had a very, very rich childhood in a way. My brothers and sisters were all sent to work when they left primary school. I was the first one to go to secondary school. I was the fourth child. And although I grew up in one sense almost as a single child from that time on, it was a rich world.
Yes.
And I had the bush behind us, and that was my love. My father was a very fine bushman, amongst other things. So it was a great world.
And the grandmother's books, a lot of those were to do with art as well, weren't they?
So there were a lot of them to do with art, although I still have quite a few of them, and they've got such fascinating titles, such as The Conflict of Science and Religion, the Zoroastrian something or other, and all these weird titles, Their broad reading was really very broad and quite extraordinary. Yes. They were Unitarians, incidentally, and one reason for leaving Britain and leaving Yorkshire was that they felt that the Church of England was persecuting, and in a way it was.
Yes.
It wouldn't recognise their baptism and all that sort of stuff.
Yes. Yes. So your earliest career was not in the visual arts, though, wasn't it? You were a cub reporter for the Northern Advocate, I think.
Yes, I finished my fourth year at Whangarei Boys High School, where there was no art being taught. And I was a bit lost for what to do because my parents obviously couldn't afford to send me to university. But I had a wonderful English teacher, and he won me a job on the Northern Advocate as a young reporter. And that, again, was a very rich and valuable experience because the senior reporters were away at the war. This was during the war years. And so I was doing magistrates' court work, hospital board work, all of this stuff as a 17-year-old. And I had to grow up pretty quickly. But it was good for me, and it also... I thought at that stage my life was going to be in the field of writing.
Yes.
And writing was what fascinated me.
Well, the regional newspapers were very important, and again are. I think that the readership of regional newspapers is actually increasing faster than readership of the metropolitan newspapers, which says something about people wanting to know about their community and be in touch with issues.
I think that's a wise remark, because I think, personally, I have little time for the major newspapers such as New Zealand Herald, which don't have really good sound worldwide commentaries in them to any large extent. But I think the provincial newspapers can still pull community interest together, and I think that's demonstrated recently.
So what took you away from the world of journalism into education?
I was sacked.
You were sacked. That's quite a good reason.
My sub-editor came to me one day and said, Peter, you no longer got a job with us. I just about burst into tears because I loved it. I thought, that was wonderful. I said, what have I done wrong? He said, you've done nothing wrong, he said, but the men are going to come back from overseas. You'll just be a junior around the place. It'll be a dog's body job. You need more education. I said, I can't afford more education. He said, yes, you can. Go to teachers' college. They pay you to go there, but you don't have to teach if you don't want to. So I went. And that's where I began to get my feelings for art, mostly due to quite a remarkable man, Charlton Edgar. He was a Canadian watercolourist, and he took a real interest in me and gave me an extra year of training, what they call the third year of art.
Uh-huh. And, yes, Charlton Edgar is one of those names you used to hear quite frequently in conversation, and now it's just slipped into, well, pretty much obscurity, I would think.
Yes, I think that there were people like Charlton who suffered a bit from the push from certain quarters at one stage or another to ensure that we had a national identity.
Yes.
And they were very, very wary or scathing about overseas people.
Yes.
And I've always felt that that's been an interesting aspect of the early development of New Zealand art, actually.
And Alan Pearson would agree with you entirely and say it's still alive and strong in New Zealand.
Yes, I believe it is. Mm. I believe it is.
Mm. So Teachers College training and that Charlton Edgar and the college awakened the interest in art, which had been formed at home anyway, much earlier.
Yes.
And you began painting at that time?
I began painting, but I was no painter, Rodney. I was, because I had no formal training, and but I thought I liked painting better than the crafts. Now, we had three women, Miss Curnow, Miss Bruce, and I forget the name of the other one. They were splendid craftswomen, weavers, bookbinders, and they taught me a wide range of superb skills, which I still have, I believe.
Yes.
And in retrospect, I think that balance of that craft side was the makings of me in terms of a discipline, because my art was shallow and superficial, in my opinion, looking back on it. I did pretty watercolours.
Yes, well, I'd be horrified to think about what I did. But even a bit later, when I went to art school, you know, in Christchurch, it was a very different situation than now. And you tell people and they look at you wide-eyed with astonishment. But we did Roman lettering. We did technical drawing. We drew from the antique. We're all those classic things that quite soon after my time were discarded, but they were provided a very good basis of skill and craft on which to build.
Yes, and I think that's what I lacked, because I didn't have that background. But nevertheless, that's okay. As a result of that third year of training, I happened by good fortune to have my first appointment as an advisor to the art and craft branch of the Department of Education, as it was then, under Gordon Tovey. And I was an art advisor until 1956, in fact, employed by the department. And that was an extremely interesting period, because it was the burgeoning of a whole new move in the direction of art education in the primary sector, a big shift. I don't want to dwell on that Tovey period, because there's a whole Tovey mythology which exaggerates a lot, mostly done by his ardent followers of that period rather than Tovey himself, to do the man justice.
Yes.
But in one sense, I recognised the other day, thinking about this and talking to my wife Jill about it, who's in this field also, that what happened was that under the influence of people like Herbert Read and Lowenfeld and writers of that sort, there was this notion that art could be an instrument for the development of qualities of personality and investigation. So they saw art as a tool, not as an end in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a distinction which not many people recognise from that time. Art wasn't, it wasn't a search to make art, it was a search to build the person.
Mm.
We never ever were quite sure, some of us, people like Merv Holland and Dick Seeley and Jim Allen and so on, what was supposed to happen to these children when they grew up. Were they to remain childlike?
What yes. Yes.
And it wasn't until people like Brent Wilson, who I listened to with great interest at an INSEER conference in Amsterdam, made an announcement which horrified the whole audience, that child art was a ridiculous myth, and that you know, we had to recognise that the children are influenced by the things that they see on the wall hanging at home. That's their real art influence. And it was an interesting period, though.
Yes, yes. You must have been one of the first arts advisors in Tovey.
One of the first.
Now, you've mentioned the mythologising of Gordon Tovey, and one senses that. Certainly there are ardent supporters and former members of that art advisory service. Tell us a little bit about what was the situation before Gordon Tovey, and what was it about Gordon Tovey that changed things?
The history is interesting. There had been quite a history of various curriculum introduction of art into the New Zealand curriculum, primary school curriculum. One has to recognise that at that stage, and for a long time afterwards, secondary schools were still controlled by their boards of governors. And the Department of Education had very little influence, although it wanted it, they didn't have it. So the movements began within the primary field. And one of the most important people in this whole story was Clarence Beeby, who was Director of Education. He became a good friend of mine, and he was a superb mind. And he had this idea that there needed to be more within the curriculum than the pedestrian so-called 3 hours. But his emphasis, for which he recruited Doreen Bloomhart, was on the craft side. That's what he saw as the proper future.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was responsible for the development, under Peter Fraser as Minister of Education, for the establishment of the art and craft branch. And Tovey was appointed as the first supervisor. And he was very, very much in tune with these ideas of the child art programs. And in one sense, Tovey was an enigma. He was very much influenced by Jungian philosophy. He was something rather mystical about him, and also he was anti-intellectual. Mm. One of the things that where Jim Allen and John Ritchie and I and a few others fell out with him was that because we had formal backgrounds in art and university degrees, mm. and he did not like this intellectual approach and thought that we were sort of traitors to the cause.
I see.
Yes. At the same time, I do him credit because he did shift, made a major shift in the whole face yes. of art education. What he did do was he virtually abandoned the craft side of it because it was called the art and craft branch, mm. and there was as much emphasis on bookbinding and weaving and clay as upon painting. But Toby himself, a painter, was very concerned that it focus upon the visual arts because they were the expressive mode, as he mm-hmm. saw it, mm-hmm. the proper avenue for child development. And so he virtually subverted B.B.'s original ideas.
Yes. Mm. And so as an art advisor, you and your colleagues would go out into the schools and advise the teachers? Was that the process?
Yes, we were given a group. I was based in Auckland with four or five others, I think, in that initial year. The number increased until we had about 14 in the advisors. But we were given an allocation of schools which ranged from Auckland City schools right up through Northland. Mm-hmm. And we just had to make regular visits to them. It was another learning curve because we ran into a good deal of opposition, particularly from grizzly old principals who didn't yes. want any of this fancy art stuff.
Yes.
And I'll just bore you with one incident where I was in a school and this crusty old deputy principal he said, "Well, I suppose I've got to let you in the room." So I went in there and took the lesson and finished up the lesson. At the end of it, he said, "Tear that lot up, put it in the bin, now we get on to the real work." And that was the world we faced.
Yes.
And you had to sort of steel yourself yeah. To go into these places because they were pretty fierce and we were yes. youngsters.
Yes.
Yeah. But gradually he became, like many others, one of my great supporters.
Yes.
Because he began to see when the children began saying, "Can we have more of that? Can we have more of that?" The shift began and it just penetrated.
Mm.
That was really rather wonderful.
Now, when I was a student of yours in 1966, you permitted me to do a teaching section up at Te Kau and then to visit all the Northland Māori schools. And for a boy from Christchurch, that was an eye-opener. So you were there going around those small schools a lot earlier than that.
Yes, I was.
It must have been a contrast with what yes. was happening here in
yes.
the city.
Yes. Actually, the country schools were very welcoming.
Yes.
I think probably because in one sense it was wonderful to have a visitor.
Yes.
Because they were lonely places, often with a sole charge teacher or only one or two teachers. And I had a lot of contact with the North. And of course I was working with Elwyn Richardson and Jim Allen on the ROID project.
Yes.
Which was quite a remarkable development.
So then what happened after that? Then you went into teacher training.
What happened was that I think Gordon Toby recognised, rather grudgingly, but he recognised and came to me one day and said, "Look, I realise we are not doing anything worthwhile within the secondary field." He said, "I wonder if I could second you to the Auckland Teachers College to set up a training scheme for secondary school art teachers."
Right.
That was in 1953.
Right.
And for 2 years or 3 years, I was on a secondment there as still a member of the Department of Education. And I think that's probably when we went up north, I think, yeah. during that period, because we had use of public service cars still. I set up this first training scheme. That first training scheme, as you all know, drew on art school graduates from both Ilam and Elam. The two established art schools in New Zealand at that time. And so there was this wonderful mix of Christchurch and Auckland, and it was a very rich period. Some wonderful people came through. I can remember people, just the wonderful... He became a lifelong friend until his unfortunate death at an early age, Ted Bullmore.
Yes.
Here was this Canterbury forward, B. big, rugged, sturdy individual, yes. gentle as a lamb, you yes. know, and a wonderful painter, in my opinion. He's yes. never been fully recognised in this country as he should be.
Yeah, indeed.
So I had people like that. I had Arnold Wilson. He was the first Maori to do my course. He was a bit wayward and difficult to control, so one didn't really try too hard. In fact, I think I made lots of concessions to my students in those days. Yeah. Somehow or other, it was a time, I suppose, Rodney, at that stage, many of the graduates had a formal training in sculpture or painting, but not much more than that. Some, very few in the design territory. And I thought my job, because of the demands of secondary school teaching, was to widen their grasp of art processes and craft processes.
Yes.
And so my programs early on were really fairly in, very much centred around activity of making stuff and doing stuff.
Exactly.
Yeah. There were people like Neil Grant who had come up from Christchurch at one stage, and he said, I'm a sculptor, but he was introduced to the potter's wheel, and that became his whole venue, his whole thing.
The pottery program was fantastic. Out.
Robin White was in my group, and I introduced her to screen printing, and yes. she carried on with the screen printing. So these were the lovely little things that happened, you know, rather wonderful things that happened.
No, it was an enjoyable place to be, is my recollection. Then, of course, we were dragged out of your clutches a few times a week to try and make us literate and do some things that would equip us to be teachers. But, in fact, our hearts were always with you.
Yes, it was interesting because I can remember that I think there was a compulsory requirement to do physical education and language and education studies and things like this. And you were a pretty reluctant lot. But the little funny little old prefab was, I think, a pretty happy place.
Yes, it was.
Mostly because of what you people brought to me. Your contributions were as big as mine, in my opinion. I had people like, as I said, Ted Bulmore, Bill Colbert, people like this.
Mm.
And they were quite inspirational in terms of their understandings and feelings about things. And we were really the best of a pedagogical arrangement, I think, of teacher-learner, whereas I was not instructing. I was learning as much as they were. Mm. So it was sort of a mutual process, in my opinion.
And did you... I mean, if Tovey had a program of the kind that you described, did you have a similar program? And clearly, part of what you were there to do was to broaden the skill base, take these people who had specialised at art school in one particular avenue of the visual arts and give them a wider range of skills that would be useful for children. But what were you seeing the place as of art education in schools? And do you think there was a change in that period from, let's say, the beginning of the 1960s that came into the schools as a result of it?
It began to change. The change was slow, but yes, I hoped that I was beginning to bring ideas about the role that art could play for various students of not just necessarily those of talent, but the richness that it could offer. Particularly, I was interested in heightening qualities of observation and development of technical abilities. So the programs I were designing, which are fairly basic at that time, were really the educational component of them were centred around that sort of work. But I was still caught up with a sort of one-off one lesson thing until in the 1970s, I think it probably was, it would have been the 1960s, I began to recognise one needed to shape an education program much more. And I became more and more interested in developing projects, longer term projects, where students were given a task and were set criteria to meet. That led finally towards the school certificate examination, because what had happened was that art at the secondary level was in one sense at least restricted, if not almost doomed, by the fact you could only take it up to the to the fifth form, where it was sort of the geometric drawing stuff and object drawing that you had experienced. Yes. And Jim Allen and I and John Ritchie got together in 1958 and began to work towards the development of what we saw as a necessary introduction of examinations into the secondary art curriculum. This was a battle, because that whole primary sector were adamantly opposed to any ideas about instruction which bordered on adult art. It's curious in retrospect to think how strong that opposition was. They said, this is the death of art to examine it. And I said, look, you people talk about art all the time. Every time you have a meeting, all you do is talk about this work or that work and how good or bad it is. But there was a lot of resentment about it. And when we finally came up with a proposition, and I'd be egotistical enough to say that a paper I drafted for school certificate art became the foundation paper for the new school certificate art prescription. The shift, there were two major shifts that occurred then, Rodney. One, it was criteria-based. There were four sections: qualities of observation, technical development, enhancement and development of ideas, and then final productivity. And these are the four criteria. And art teachers, secondary school art teachers, took a while to grapple with this, but then they recognised at last they had a legitimate tool for evaluating student work. It wasn't just about, I think it's good or I think it's bad. That was a big shift. The other shift, and the major one, was that I was puzzled for a long time how about we could possibly examine this with an end-of-year three-hour examination. And Bill Rennick, who was a great ally, said, Peter, I've got somebody in the department who is quite expert in terms of internal assessment. Why don't we internally assess art? And that was the first internally assessed subject in New Zealand. And that was a huge breakthrough. The students had to prepare a portfolio work. The teachers moderated it themselves, and then they submitted a sample for further testing by another moderating panel, and I think it worked magnificently. It was a real success. I mention this because the outcome was... Oh, I should go back a bit and say... No, I'll carry on with that. I mention this because it began to shift the whole amount of enrolment in art as a subject at secondary schools. In 2 years' time, after the introduction of school certificate art, we had lifted the student range from to 500% above what it was previously.
Yes,
you know, you'd have one in five before then,
because art had been compulsory at third and fourth form, hadn't it? But then it was an optional subject for school cert.
Yes.
Now, in the second half of the '70s, of course, then university entrance art and university entrance art history arrived.
The first one was art history. 1969, that began. That was the first year. It was pretty simple. It was a so-called survey from Greece to the present day. This whole huge span. And, of course, it became a sort of a cursory process. And I think Professor Green, had been appointed chair at Auckland Art History Department, was a moving force at that stage, because he said, no, he said, we need an examination which begins to equip people to understand the historical methods which are used in art. And so we did a major shift and moved through to a revision of that, and then we were able to introduce bursary and scholarship art following that. Those were extremely important formative years.
Yes.
They reshaped the whole... not only the intake, but the whole attitude towards art by schools, by parents. And I remember people like Rodney Kirk-Smith coming to me and saying, I couldn't understand for quite a while why we were having this influx of children coming into the gallery with their parents. He said, it's been wonderful, he said, but what has happened? I said, that's because the children are having to do this study and investigate the nature of artwork, so they drag their parents along.
Yes.
So this had a lovely overflow effect. It was very, very, very effective, I think. I sound very positive about this, but I am positive about it. It was a good period.
I taught for 1 year in 1969, and I had a UE class. So it must have been that very first year.
It would have been.
And I taught at Wairoa College. It had then, and presumably still has, the largest Māori role. And I remember at one of the examinations, one of the students came back on the question to do with Greek sculpture and identified the artist as Parasites. And I thought to myself, and a curiously appropriate name for me teaching Greek and Roman art in Wairoa, Hawke's Bay. But yes, fortunately changed. It was a quick gallop, wasn't it, that year?
Well, in one sense, it amuses me what you say, because in one sense, my wife Jill, who is my second wife, she has become something of an international expert in the field of multicultural education. That's where her doctorate lies. But she did part of her thesis study was looking at how secondary art teachers treated the culturally different within their schools and what approaches they made, if any, towards them. And she said she went out to one Auckland school, which I won't name, in which this teacher, 2 years ago, was still teaching them to draw from Greek vases, to study Greek heads, and that was still the program. So, but that was pretty rare.
Yes. And university entrance art arrived, and what year was that?
University entrance art was 1969.
69 also?
70.
Right, approximately.
1970, yes. Hmm.
And how did that get there? Why suddenly? Because school certificate art had existed, and this was the next step on.
Well, the history of art, which began in 69, the first year, as you remember, preceded the revision of school certificate art.
Yes.
And then we recognised that there was a hole in the system, because the students couldn't study anything which led towards that study in the fifth form level.
Right.
And we introduced the school certificate revision at that stage to fill that gap, in a way, I suppose, if that's the right term. But
yes.
But it had a flow-on effect in that respect. Hmm.
So, Peter, you've seen through these major changes, the formalisation by art achieving, first of all, recognition in the secondary system, then school certificate status, and then, along with art history, university entrance status. And you've had passed through your hands over all those years an astonishing range of people who have become both some of our finest artists and some of our finest teachers. Then you ended up principal of the Combined Teachers College.
Yes, I did. But I'd like to go back just to mention just how extraordinary my contacts have been and how rich they've been. Excuse me. In 1968, I had a group which included Terry Stringer, Ian Scott, Claudia Pond-Eiley, Robin White, my wife Jill, about four or five others, brilliant people, Warren Briscoe, all of these people.
Yes.
What a brilliant year, what brilliant people.
Yes.
And all of those people, as Jill reminded me the other day when I was talking to her about this, she said, you realise that most of us are still either educators or artists. We have stayed with it. And
yes.
That's wonderful.
Yes.
And these people, of course, became lifelong friends and
yes.
Very rewarding. But they were tremendous people. But what happened was that in 1974, although I was still enjoying my job, I was at that stage involved with the Post-Primary Teachers Association and also with the Department of Education in doing quite a lot of curriculum work on a much broader front.
Mm-hmm.
We were writing Education in Change, published by PPDA, which was quite a revolutionary doctrine in its time. And things like this were happening, and I began to feel a little bit itchy about, you know, staying and plodding along in this sort of role. And Peter Bogue, who was deputy director at the time, said, would you consider taking a lower salary but joining the inspectorate in Auckland, because we need somebody with some substance within the art field, within the inspectorate. And I accepted that because it was a challenge to me. I was an, shall we say, a standard inspector. I wasn't the art inspector. I had to do the whole routine of school visiting and everything else. It was probably one of the most critical turning points of my career because it led me into a much broader scope of education. Mm. And I was very, very fortunate that I was able to take part in many of the committees, many of the developments, many of the research investigations which led into the reform of the Education Act in 1985. Amongst other things, Bill Rennick sent me as his deputy to Paris to work on an IIEP project. That was the International Institute for Educational Planning. It was a brilliant six-nation program, and that was so rich, and I loved my time in Paris working with UNESCO there. It was a great period. Mm. And I've had these good, fortunate moves. I became a counsellor for the INSEA, the International Society for Education Through Art, which I believe is changing its name because it realises that perhaps education through art isn't quite what it's about, which is interesting to me. And a whole lot of other curriculum development. So my field became much, much broader. And I recognised that we had to place art within the whole context, social context of education. And we could not stand aloof from the other subjects and think we were superior or different or things of that sort. We had to find our proper relationship and connect. So I ended that period of my life. I became a senior inspector, and then I became a deputy to the Superintendent of Education, Pat Foley, who had a profound influence on me, a remarkable man. And at that stage of the 1980s, we were dealing with the whole face of education. We were dealing with all the problems which arise when principals get out of key with their boards of trustees. Mm. You know, we were the troubleshooters. They were confrontational times at times, but it was quick learning, you know.
Yes.
Broadened my whole educational horizon.
Yeah.
And I was due to retire in 1965 because public service education, public service rather, required one to retire at the age of 65.
Right.
I was approaching that, and suddenly I'd been working on a committee to look at whether the teacher training institutions of Auckland should have closer collaboration. And we'd worked through a very painful process because everybody wanted to protect their own niche. And they arrived at the concept of the Auckland College of Education, which combined early childhood education, primary education, secondary education, and social working under the one roof, so to speak. The job was offered, and I won it. Mm. I won a five-year contract. But my job was a specific one within that, and it was to shape up the new organisation, to deal with all of the redundancies that occurred, to reform all the administrative dimensions of it, but also to try to pull together the strands, different strands of the different institutions. It was a five-year contract. I didn't win. I never thought I've succeeded. Although some people say that I did make some fairly substantial changes. But I was fighting against the totally embedded allegiance by the other principals to their colleges or their departments. Mm. And it was a tough battle. We did make progress. I think one of my significant developments, or two, were, first of all, to give much more autonomy to the Māori department.
Mm-hmm.
Previously, the council, which was responsible for conduct of the teachers' colleges, of ACE, the Auckland College of Education, said, oh, well, yeah, we can give them a bit of freedom, but not too much. We've still got to keep them in check and keep control of their finances. And I was outraged by this, and so we actually stormed the council meeting with a group of local komatua and so on, and we won. We won that autonomy for them. They had responsibility, and that meant that they had to accept failure as well as success.
Yes, indeed.
Which is the whole key to professionalism, in my opinion.
Indeed.
And that was one victory. The other one might seem slightly different, but that was that I think we were the first tertiary institution to introduce proper processes for against sexual harassment. And that was another breakthrough period for me. And that was another stroppy committee, but it was a good one to work with. And there were other things that happened at that time which were very rewarding. And then in 1989-90, my formal period was over.
Yeah. Now, all through this, Peter, while you were orchestrating art education and finally education in its largest sense, you've been a craftsman, a meticulous craftsman, sailor and boat builder, just as your father was.
Yes. I think I converted one of my father's dinghies at the age of 12.
Yes.
Put a centreboard in it and a sail on it, and I've been sailing ever since. And I had this deep love. My father was, amongst other things, when he was in Auckland, a very enthusiastic yachtsman. He had a top-class racing boat built by the Logans, the Doreen, and she was what they called a pataki, and the patakis were so fast that they were banned from racing by the older craft, which were much slower. Mm-hmm. And they went down, most of them went to Napier or out to Blockhouse Bay. But when my father lost his job and when we became a depression family, he never sailed again. He never set foot in a boat again. And I often lament that fact, you know. But he did teach me a lot. He was a wonderful, wonderful father. I had two older brothers and an older sister. He had a fine workshop. His care of his tools was absolutely meticulous, as you'd imagine. He never denied us use of those tools.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we must have blunted so many saws, chipped so many chisels, and broken so many drills.
Yes.
But he never complained.
Yeah.
He never tried to teach us, so to speak, in the direct sense, but we were always free, and I suppose by osmosis or something or other, we all became good craftspeople.
Education by exploration.
Yes, yes.
Now, yes. Peter, you amongst many other things, but this is part of the origins of it, at least in my mind, purchased a little boat, I think her name was Dolphin, you renamed her Rebecca.
Yes.
Did a restoration of her, wrote a book about her. This was all before the surge of interest that we're experiencing now in classic New Zealand craft. So you really were a pioneer of the rediscovery of New Zealand's sailing heritage.
I'm very proud of the fact that Harold Kidd, who you know...
Yes.
Harold, at the recent launching of a big book, Classic Boats, said during his address, "We must remember that sitting out there in the audience is Peter Smith. His restoration of Dolphin, which he renamed Rebecca, started a movement which has not stopped ever since." And I thought that was a wonderful, wonderful compliment he paid me, because he said exactly that.
That's literally true.
That was the beginning of that. I had already bought, in 1968, Moana, the old Logan Classic. But my marriage dissolved at that stage, and so went to trust to my sons. And they still own her, and she sits down there, and she's just going back in the water next week after a refit.
Yes.
She's as beautiful as ever.
Yes.
But I was talking to my son, Chris, my elder son. He's an engineer. And I said to Chris, "You know, Chris, I'm thinking of building another sailing dinghy. I do miss the actual feeling of sailing." And he looked at me and he said, "Dad, you just like designing and building boats." And I think he was probably right, that my joy comes as much out of the designing and building as anything else. I was very proud of the fact that Jill and I, my wife and I, were able to build Pacific Icon, a 36-footer of my own design. I met Laurie Davidson two days...
And sailor around the Pacific, too.
Yes. Yeah, we raced her up to Sula and Noumea and places like that. I met Laurie Davidson 2 days ago, and just by accident, and I was talking to him, and he said, "Thank you for the book you sent me," he said. I must say, I thought the Pacific Icon that you designed and built was one of the most beautiful boats I've seen in a long time. And I thought that from Laurie Davidson was as good as it gets.
Indeed.
He said, "You used to challenge my boats, didn't you, the 36ers? And I said, "Yeah, we gave them a good go." So the crafting side of it is still with me. I've just finished doing building all the wooden, traditional wooden blocks for Corona, a big mullet boat that's going in the water on Saturday. I'm doing some teak gratings for Moana at the moment. So it keeps on going. My wife says, without a project, what would I do with you? You know, she's probably right. I'm not ready to sit in an armchair yet.
No, well, look at you. You're lively and engaged. And at the end, I suppose one has to call it that, the end of a formidable life of professional and personal achievement.
I personally think that I have had a most fortunate life. I really do. I'm grateful for all that's happened. Even a period of acute illness was in its sense a learning thing, because it taught my wife and I to sort out and check what really is of value, what really matters. And that's a sort of, sounds a bit pretentious, but that's a sort of credo that we live by. And so, yeah, I am fortunate in having Jill, because I so admire what she has done developing her career. And she is now very much in international demand. She's overseas four times last year. She's pressed with invitations, but she's wanting to slow down a bit now.
Well, you and Jill, you've been a wonderful team. Thank you, Peter. That's been a splendid sketch of a very productive life, and one that has been hugely influential on a large number of people. Thank you.
Thank you, Rodney.